Chapter 5. Pavlov in Your Pocket. How to Help Your Dog Overcome His Fears. I remember the storm that almost killed Blue, as if it had just happened. The thunder was so loud I gave up trying to sleep, and alternated between reading and attending to my dogs, who were clustered around me, panting and pacing. A huge branch, itself the size of a tree, blew off the weeping willow in the front yard. I was sure the power would go out, and it did. Right on schedule, about an hour into the fury of a typical Wisconsin thunderstorm. The Midwest may seem like a quiet backwater to some, but not to those of us who live here. In part, that's because of the weather. Thanks to tornadoes, thunderstorms, and blizzards, we don't need to watch television to bring drama into our lives. I thought about that as I hunkered down on the second story of my old farmhouse, hoping that the maple tree didn't fall on the garage and that the roof stayed on the barn for one more year. Blue lived a mile and a half down the road. He was a working dog who lived outside, the better to protect an organic vegetable farm. It wasn't people who were the concern. It was deer. You may not think of deer as dangerous predators, but that's because you're not a cabbage. Deer can eat up a season's worth of vegetables in just one night, and they are hard to keep out once they learn that there's a buffet open in the neighborhood. Blue had proved himself invaluable to Vermont Valley Farm, living in the middle of the most vulnerable crops, barking at the first sign of deer. The smorgasbord in the fields may have tempted the local Bambies, but the presence of Blue was enough to convince them to eat elsewhere. Surely that night the deer were hunkered down, finding what protection they could from the pouring rain and flashes of lightning. Blue had done the same in past storms, but not this time. We'll never know why this storm was the one that sent him over the edge, but it did him in. No longer content to seek shelter in his doghouse, Blue ran in terror through the tomato vines, across the cornfield, trying somehow to outrun the thunder. Tearing wild-eyed down the center line of a country highway, Blue came within inches of being hit by a passing motorist. The driver saw him at the last instant and managed to avoid a collision. Blue's luck continued. His savior was a local and knew where Blue belonged. Blue was happy to jump into his truck and was escorted home to safety while the thunder still rolled and the sky flashed from light to dark. Fear may be essential to survival, but sometimes it can work against us. That's as true for dogs as for people. Thousands of dogs die every year because, terrified of thunderstorms, they run headlong onto highways or launch themselves out of second-story windows, trying to outrun the noise. Thunderphobia is only one type of fear that can do dogs more harm than good. But it's a good reminder that both people and dogs can suffer terribly from chronic and acute fear. Some individuals are so afraid of strangers that they can barely manage normal social interactions and live their lives in a state of chronic anxiety. Others have been frightened so intensely that they develop post-traumatic stress disorder and live in a constant state of hyperarousal. The good news is that many of these conditions in both people and dogs can be cured or at least substantially improved. That's what this chapter is about. How to help dogs whose fears are compromising their lives and the lives of the people who love them. However, before we talk about what to do, I want to talk about what not to do. I wish I didn't have to bother, but the fact of the matter is, instinct often isn't enough when it comes to dealing with frightened dogs. Spare the rod, please. There's one universal truth that relates to all fear-related behavior in both people and dogs. Punishment is not a good way to fix it. You'd think it would be obvious that hitting or yelling at a frightened dog would be counterproductive, but sad to say, people do it all the time. I suspect that the reason has more to do with our own emotions than those of our dogs. Frightened dogs can also be aggressive dogs, at least in the sense that some dogs growl and flash their teeth when they feel threatened. These dogs don't want to hurt anyone, although they might if trapped or pushed too far. Usually, they're just trying to defend themselves, and they're using the only means they have. We respond, understandably, with our own set of fears. As primates, we have a visceral reaction to something coming at us with teeth bared, as well we should. Nothing like a set of white, shiny teeth to get a rise out of your limbic system, even if part of you has noticed that the dog's facial expression includes signs of fear. Take it from me, never does your skin feel quite so thin and useless as when a dog is about to sink her teeth into it. If a dog is flashing her teeth at you or someone else, it takes a special kind of training or a high level of empathy to focus on her fears rather than your own. You'd be wise to try to see the world through her eyes, at least to the extent of acknowledging that fear is one component of the dog's behavior. Aggression often breeds aggression, and never is that more true than if it's motivated by fear. It's a sad irony that one of the things we share with dogs is the tendency to become aggressive when we're frightened. Defensive aggression is common in both species, and it can feed on itself like a forest fire. Surely, the most common fear in all mammals is the fear of being hurt. This isn't surprising when you think about it. Being injured isn't going to help an animal pass on its genes. It's a shame dogs can't more easily tell us when they're hurt or afraid of being hurt, because I think it's a common motivation for what we think of as aggression. If only people would be more anthropomorphic when their dogs are behaving badly. I'm surprised at how few of us think of pain as a motivation for the growls and snaps that some dogs are so quick to deliver. Pain is a common factor in aggression in our own species, ask any hospital nurse, and you'd think we'd be quicker to consider it when our dogs get snappy. I remember one dog, a lovely little Springer, who had bitten her owner repeatedly and badly whenever she reached toward her collar. The dog seemed sweet and submissive at all other times, perfectly happy to let me handle her paws, take away a special chew bone, and ask her to lie down and stay. The owner had been told that the dog had dominance-related aggression, but the context of the bites didn't look as if she was trying to control the household. She just couldn't tolerate anyone reaching toward her collar. In the office, I noticed that her movements seemed a bit stiff and asked whether the dog had been given a thorough medical exam. She had, but her vet had found nothing on the x-rays to suggest a problem. Because the aggression was elicited only by a reach toward her neck, and because her movements seemed just the slightest bit wrong, I suggested a second opinion. Bless the client's heart, she took her dog for a second opinion, got referred to a certified canine chiropractor who located a misaligned vertebrae, and in just one treatment, the dog was restored to her sweet, docile self. This kind of miracle cure is rare. It's probably one of the reasons I remember the case so well, but it serves as a good reminder that dogs can be aggressive because they are afraid of being hurt. Punishing her for growling and snapping, which the owners had tried, only exacerbated her fear and made things worse. If you're in the middle of a vicious circle of fear-related aggression between you and your dog, don't expect your dog to figure a way out, although I've seen a number of dogs do their best to try. You're the human with the big, brilliant cortex, so if you see signs of fear in your dog, as described in Chapter 2, take a deep breath, tell your limbic system to calm down, and think yourself out of the problem. If fear could be a component in your dog's behavior, you need to take the threat away and work on teaching him what you do want him to do, not punishing him for what he did wrong. Try to avoid getting caught up in a spiral of fear, because it can be a downhill ride to trouble. Here's another example, a regrettably common one, of how punishment only exacerbates problems that are based on fear. Someone's shy dog snaps at an unfamiliar visitor who overwhelms her by trying to kiss her on the face. Alarmed and embarrassed, the owner yells at the dog and smacks her on the rump. Ask yourself, what did the dog learn? Most likely, she had her fears confirmed. Yes, unfamiliar people are just as dangerous as I thought they were, and worse, my own owner, whom I was counting on to protect me, becomes dangerous in their presence as well. I hope no one unfamiliar ever comes into our house again. Being punished for acting out of fear is a staggeringly common problem. I've worked with countless dogs who were punished for growling when they were afraid of a person or another dog. Many did indeed stop growling, but these dogs are often more dangerous than the ones that keep it up. Afraid to growl, they sit stiff and silent, but ready to blow at the slightest provocation. If people aren't aware of the meaning of a closed mouth and a stiff body, they push the dog until he can't control himself any longer, and he lashes out. without warning. Out of the blue, the owners tell me. His bites come from out of the blue with no warning whatsoever. And yet, when I reach toward the dog in a consultation, his mouth closes tight, his body freezes, and his eyes round like dinner plates. All along, the poor dog had been trying to tell them he was about to blow, but they took away the only warning system they understood, growling, and couldn't interpret the signals that were left. Some dogs don't stop growling if they're punished for it. They escalate the barking and growling in a desperate attempt to keep the approaching person as far away as possible. "You stay away from me. You're dangerous. If you get any closer, my owner is going to hurt me. Stay away from me. Barararararar." This, too, is a common reaction to being punished for fear-related behavior, and I've seen hundreds of dogs in my office whose quiet growls evolved into deep, hateful barks because their owners had inadvertently confirmed their worst fears. I said, "Get over here." There's another reason that people use punishment in response to fearful dogs, and it, too, relates more to our own emotions than to those of our dogs. Fearful dogs are sometimes afraid to respond as asked, and dogs who don't listen can result in frustrated, angry owners. We'll talk about that in depth in the chapter on anger, but for now, suffice it to say that getting angry at a frightened dog rarely solves the problem. This is yet another time when being anthropomorphic can help both you and your dog. Would your performance improve if someone slapped you because you were nervous before giving a speech? I'll admit that in rare cases, that kind of shock might be helpful. Thanks, I needed that. But that's the exception, not the rule. I was so nervous when I gave my first academic speech at a scientific meeting that my goal was to make it through without fainting or throwing up. I did, but the graduate student who spoke after me dropped like a rock in a dead faint after his first few sentences. I suppose if someone had slapped him beforehand, it might have improved things. He could have fainted in private instead of in front of 500 people. Although it's important to avoid doing things that make your dog worse, there are a lot of things you can do to help your dog conquer her fears. The methods described below work as well on people as they do on dogs, a handy fact to remember next time you have to give a speech. I've used them myself to get over my own fear of public speaking and to keep myself from bolting out of the chair at the dentist's office. I've written all the examples with dogs as subjects, but don't hesitate to think about how you can get these methods to work for you, too. Classical conditioning. Unless your dog was both born profoundly shy and grew up all alone in a shed, chances are you can do a lot to soothe her fears. The best way to do that is to use classical conditioning, the type of learning discovered by the Russian scientist Ivan Pavlov and his drooling dogs. Unlike most of us who don't appreciate long, slimy strings of drool, Pavlov wanted his dogs to salivate so that he could study the extra-large chromosomes that saliva contains. However, he was frustrated when they began producing drool before he was ready to collect it. He had expected them to start salivating when they got their food, but the dogs would start dancing and drooling long before, when they heard their dinner bowls being handled or the sound of the keeper's footsteps approaching the door. This is not a stunning revelation to most of us who are used to our dogs anticipating something they love with excitement, doing jumping jacks when we pick up the leash or open a can of food. No doubt dogs have been doing similar things for ages, spinning joyful circles when some human-like primates picked up their clubs and put on animal skins on the way out of the cave. But it was Pavlov who first realized the implications of the fact that dogs would drool in response to a sound rather than to food. He recognized that by linking two previously unrelated things, you could get the same response to one as you did to the other. Not only that, but the response wasn't voluntary or under conscious control. You can't make yourself salivate, at least not without conjuring up an image of food, which is just another example of classical conditioning. Many of us can't stop ourselves from blinking before a camera flashes, because the anti-red eye feature includes a small flash that is always followed by the real, brighter flash. Unconsciously, we've learned that the first, weaker flash, which is normally not enough to make you close your eyes, means a larger flash is coming. The sequence starts out little flash, big flash, blink, and turns into little flash, blink, big flash. You can illustrate this yourself without a camera by pairing a clicking sound with a puff of air blown into your eye. After as few as 10 trials, you'll find yourself blinking just to the click in anticipation of the puff of air. You don't decide to do it, it just happens. Pavlov was so impressed by what he found that he changed his scientific focus and spent the rest of his life studying the process of classical conditioning. He published 513 papers on classical conditioning and found that it occurred in every species he studied. His work suggested that, ideally, the neutral stimulus, the bowl, the leash, the bell, should be presented about a half a second before the stimulus that naturally evokes a response, dinner, a walk, visitors at the door, and that the neutral stimulus needed to come first for the association to be made. In other words, your dog associates the doorbell with visitors because it rings before they enter the house, not afterward. But even Pavlov would be astounded by the implications of his discovery and by what we've recently learned about the power of classical conditioning to affect emotions and behavior. The effects of this type of learning on the lives of people and animals are extraordinarily far-reaching. In one notable example, a researcher paired a red light with the introduction of a receptive female into a male quail's cage. Sure enough, after a few repetitions, the males became excited by red lights alone, and if a female did come to visit, the males produced more sperm and more semen and copulated faster if there was a red light on. You have to love the researcher's choice of color. Lest you start to feel smug about the foolishness of a male quail, keep in mind that people are as susceptible to conditioning as birds. Malcolm Gladwell, in the book Blink, recounts a study in which people's behavior could be affected by the task of creating four-word sentences from seemingly random sets of words. But the words weren't random. Each set contained one word associated with old age, either directly or indirectly. Examples are shoes give replace old thee, and sunlight makes temperature wrinkle raisins. Believe it or not, simply reading words such as old and wrinkle embedded within four neutral words was enough to cause people to walk more slowly when they left the room than they did when they entered it. At no time were the subjects aware that their brains had unconsciously focused upon the words associated with old age and had cued their bodies to behave appropriately. Apparently, you are what you eat needs to be broadened to you are what you read. I just about fell off my chair as I finished that paragraph, realizing for the first time that there just might be a tiny little connection between the fact that I have become more and more fearful about my ability to do justice to the subject matter of this chapter, which would be, fear. Good grief. I've read tall stacks of articles on fear, and the word fear seems to be burned into my brain. And even though I've been reading and writing about fear for several months, it just occurred to me that there might be a connection between that and my own emotions. This stuff is scary. Heaven help my friends. The next chapter is on anger. Unconscious associations like these are happening all the time to every human on the planet. That's why advertisers spend so much money linking cuddly cute puppies to their products, so you'll feel the same good feelings about toilet paper and laundry soap as you do about dewy-eyed baby dogs. It's no accident that beer commercials usually contain stunningly beautiful and scantily clad women. Long, lustrous hair and hourglass figures may have nothing to do with beer, but they evoke the kind of interest and desire that beer producers want viewers to feel for their product. However, as we've seen, classical conditioning isn't always a good thing for either species. Remember the little boy Albert who was traumatized in the laboratory? His terror of anything furry is a perfect, though tragic, example of classical conditioning, in which the soft, white rat elicited the same response as a fear-inducing noise. Examples of this phenomenon abound in daily life. You may feel a bit sad every time you hear the song that played when you broke up with your first love. Chemotherapy patients become so conditioned to feeling nauseated in a medical facility that many of them begin to feel sick any time they enter a clinic. This can become a serious problem for some patients, so much so that there is actually medical literature on it. Here in my own hometown, one former cancer patient illustrated the phenomenon when she ran into her chemotherapy nurse in the supermarket. "Susan," she said to the woman, who 2 years before had administered the nausea-inducing medicine, "it's good to see you again," and promptly threw up on the organic broccoli. Obviously, the same process can work against our dogs as well, and explains why some of our dogs begin to drool and whine long before a storm occurs, or start to shake uncontrollably in the vet's waiting room. However, once you know how to use it, classical conditioning can do as much to prevent fear in your dog as it does to cause it. It's also the most effective way to treat a fear that has already developed. In a satisfying irony, Blue's thunderphobia was exacerbated because of classical conditioning, but it was classical conditioning that cured him. Speaking of phobias, this is a good place to talk about them in a bit more depth, because they provide important insights into how to use classical conditioning so that it's on your side. Phobias. What's most confusing about dogs' phobias, whether thunderphobias or separation anxieties, is that they seem to come out of nowhere. Blue lived through several thunderstorm seasons at the farm without reacting fearfully. That's typical. Thunderphobia usually arises between the ages of 3 and 7 years and isn't related to any specific event or trauma. The origins of phobias are also mysterious in people. As a matter of fact, this is one of the identifying features that distinguishes a phobia from a simple fear. What does make sense about phobias is the object of the fear. Phobias are usually defined as persistent, extreme, and irrational fears, but they're not quite as irrational as they might seem. Phobias are most commonly directed toward things that could actually be dangerous. People are most often phobic about snakes or spiders or being high up in space, not about flowers or birthday cakes. Cynophobia, or a human's excessive fear of dogs, is less common than a fear of snakes or spiders, but nevertheless represents a significant percentage of phobias directed toward animals. 36% of animal-related phobias are directed toward dogs and or cats. Regrettably, this is not an unreasonable fear, given that there are an estimated 4.2 million dog bites a year in the United States alone. A person's fear may be excessive. Starting to sweat when looking at a photograph of a spider doesn't make a lot of sense, but it's not unreasonable to be afraid of spiders. Spiders bite, and the bites of some, such as the black widow spider, can be serious, in some cases even fatal. Dogs suffer from phobias too, and just like us, they usually develop their phobias around something with real potential to cause harm, like storms with lots of thunder and lightning, or being left alone with no ability to care for themselves if their humans don't return. Sadly, many of our dogs' phobias are explained away by placing the blame squarely on the shoulders of the owners, a practice that reminds me of the days when many in the healthcare professions blamed Down syndrome and autism on the behavior of the mother, as if she didn't have enough to cope with. In dogs, thunderphobias are often explained as a simple fear that is reinforced by owners comforting their dogs when they start to shake or pace at the sound of thunder. "Aha," said the early American behaviorists, "you're just reinforcing the bad behavior. You must ignore your dog when he's frightened of thunder." But most animals find fear so aversive that our behavior probably plays a much smaller role in our dog's fear of thunder than some have suggested. I bring up phobias now because it's classical conditioning that explains another confusing aspect of these extreme fears. It's classical conditioning that explains why a noise-phobic dog starts to shake long before she hears thunder, or why dogs with separation anxiety start to pace and whine long before you leave the house. Just like Pavlov's dogs learning that footsteps meant food was coming, our dogs learn that a seemingly harmless event tends to happen before something frightening occurs. A drop in the atmospheric pressure predicts a storm, just as the doorbell predicts a visitor. The owner putting on his coat predicts that the dog will be left alone. Because of classical conditioning, all of these things, like Pavlov's bell, can come to elicit a powerful response. Remember, the most important part of Pavlov's discovery, when a neutral event predicts something that causes an emotional response, it develops the ability to evoke the same emotion. That means your dog may be just as scared when the clouds roll in as she is when it thunders. That's also why a dog with separation anxiety is just as nervous when she sees you pick up your keys as she is once she's been left alone. Dogs with separation anxiety learn your patterns and become conditioned to your combing your hair, picking up your keys, or putting on your jacket as a precursor to your departing. Dogs with thunder phobia become nervous when the barometer drops or the sky darkens long before the thunder begins to roll. That's why so many people are unsuccessful when they attempt to cure their dog's phobias by giving the dog some tasty treats as the storm rages or as they walk out the door on the way to work. It doesn't work because the dog was already scared long before the thunder started or long before his owner left the house, and the food has come too late to do any good. Pavlov in your pocket. As I said earlier, the good news about classical conditioning is that it can do as much to alleviate your dog's fears as it can to cause them. First, you can use classical conditioning to prevent a lot of fears in your dog by predicting what might make your dog fearful in the future and linking a mild version of it with something your dog adores. For example, most dogs don't like having their paws handled, being the opposite of humans who often express affection by holding hands. They particularly hate having their nails clipped. Not only does it require that their paws be handled, but it can be painful if we inadvertently cut into the quick. You can use classical conditioning to prevent problems by starting with a young pup and giving her a tasty treat right after picking up one paw and holding it gently in your hand for half a second. In this case, you're starting with a relatively neutral stimulus, like Pavlov's bell, and linking it with something the dog loves. Food. Don't hold on to that paw too long. If you make the mistake, as many people do, of turning what should be half a second into two or three, you'll be eliciting the very emotion you're trying to prevent. Just pick up her paw for a brief moment, immediately put it down, and give her a tiny, scrumptious snack. Repeat that once or twice, and then go play ball or take her on a walk. After a few sessions of that, pick up her paw, clip off a microscopically small piece of nail, and then give her the treat. You can even condition a verbal cue. You want a manicure? And end up with a dog who wags her tail and comes running when you pick up the clippers. Granted, some dogs dislike the procedure so much that all you'll get is dutiful acceptance. But if you start by conditioning paw touches and clippers with something the dog loves, you can at least avoid meeting your dog's dark side when you need to trim her nails. Of course, you'll want to proceed more slowly if your dog has ever threatened you when you picked up her paws. If that's the case, you'll want to work with a behaviorist. You can use the same technique to prevent separation anxiety in a young pup. If you teach your dog to associate the things you do before you leave with something good, you can prevent a lot of soiled carpets and chewed windowsills in the future. The key is to know what the triggers are, what sights and sounds predict that you're about to leave, and what your dog loves, best in this case, might be a tough, hollow chew toy stuffed with your dog's favorite food. If you teach your pup to associate the jingle of your car keys with the feelings he has while slurping up liver paste, you're probably not going to be calling a behaviorist 2 years later with a dog who leaps through the window when you go to the movies. The hardest part for most people is to be patient and to start with the mildest version possible of something potentially scary. If I had just adopted a new puppy, I'd first condition him to love being in a crate or small enclosed area by letting him run in and out of it to get treats without even shutting the door initially. Over the course of the day, I'd shut the door and leave him in the crate for gradually increasing periods of time, first 2 seconds, then 5 seconds, then 30 seconds. During this early phase, your goal is to have the dog feel good when he's in the crate, even if it's for an outrageously brief period of time. It only takes a second or two to become fearful, and that's what you're trying to prevent. So keep him happy in the crate with treats or toys, and let him out long before he wants out himself. I'd also put him in the crate when he's sleepy, puppies having on-off switches like light bulbs. You can make tremendous strides in just one day by playing the crate game every hour or so, and letting your puppy sleep in it during nap time. By nightfall, you'll most likely have a puppy who has already had lots of happy emotions while being inside a crate and is much more likely to spend his first night in it asleep rather than raising the dead with his whimpers. As early as day two, I'd start getting him used to my departure by picking up my keys, putting on my jacket, and putting him in his crate with a nice, plump, stuffed toy. Long before he finished it, I'd open up the door to his crate and let him out. I want him to think, "Oh dear, don't come back yet, I'm not finished," rather than, "Oh no, I'm left here all alone." Gradually, I'd start leaving the room for half a minute, then leave the house for 5 minutes to get the mail or run down the street to pick up some milk. As the days and weeks go on, you simply increase the amount of time you leave the pup alone. Of course, there's that pesky occupation that many of us have that demands we leave the house for 8 hours or more, and we can't all take a 2-month vacation when we get a new dog. If you work Monday through Friday and you're getting a new pup, your best option is to take Friday off and get the pup early in the morning. Then you'll have 3 long days in which to settle him. By Monday morning, most pups will have had enough good experiences with your brief departures that you can leave him alone for at least half the day. If it's a young pup, you'll need to either have someone let him out of the crate at lunchtime or restrict him to an area where he can potty, because a young pup isn't going to make it all day long without relieving himself. However you manage the details, the idea is to link good feelings with your departure, being careful to start small and gradually lengthen the time your pup will be alone. Don't worry that this will be so successful that your pup will lie around in hopes you leave the house and stay away. If you have a good relationship with your dog, he's going to love to see you coming home no matter what. We all want to be loved, but few of us want a dog who is phobic about being left alone. So put Pavlov in your pocket and condition your pup to feel good when she sees you walking out the door. Of course, if your dog already has a serious case of separation anxiety, you'll need to work a lot harder to turn it around. See the references section at the back of the book for more information about treatment plans. Friend or foe? Not long ago, I heard a ruckus in my farmyard at 2 in the morning, and I padded downstairs to find out what was going on. As I stepped out of the house onto my porch, an agitated, scruffy-looking man appeared from the dark shade of my willow tree and began to run full tilt toward me. Immediately, my amygdala began to signal some chemical version of uh-oh. While my hippocampus was comparing what I was seeing with my recorded memory of what is and isn't dangerous. There's an unfamiliar, strange-looking man running fast toward a solitary woman standing in her nightgown in the middle of nowhere at 2 in the morning. This is not good. All I remember is being very, very scared and opening the door to let Tulip out of the house in the hope that just the sight of her would slow him down. Just as the approaching man lengthened his stride to leap up onto the porch, I said in the lowest, calmest voice I could muster, "Stop right there." Did I really say that? It sounds like a bad movie script, which on reflection is probably where I got it from. The guy came to a screeching halt, his eyes glued on my barking 100-pound dog, and proceeded to ask, ever so politely, whether it would be okay if he left his motorcycle under my willow tree for the night, because it had broken down in front of the farm, and a friend had come to give him a ride home, and he'd return in the morning for the bike, that is, if I didn't mind. I tried to explain that it was fine to leave his cycle in my yard, but that he might want to rethink his policy of running like a madman toward a solitary woman in a farmhouse in the middle of the night. The man may have been a bit dense, but he obviously had good intentions. However, neither Tulip nor I knew that as he dashed toward us at 2 o'clock in the morning, and you can't blame either one of us for being alarmed. This was a dog bite waiting to happen, and I bring it up now because I suspect that's what would have happened if Tulip hadn't been conditioned to associate visitors of all descriptions with treats and ball play. She was barking, and I have no doubt she'd have tried to protect me if the man had attacked, but Tulip has learned over the years to associate people coming to the house with feeling good rather than feeling fearful. That was enough to balance her concerns and avoid a brief incident turning into a serious problem. I thank Pavlov in situations like that, and every time I work with a client's dog who has gotten in trouble because he's afraid of visitors. You can use the same technique for both preventing and treating fear-related aggression in dogs. This is especially important if you have a dog who is genetically shy, like Tulip, or who didn't have much socialization as a young pup, like the Border Collie Blaze we talked about in the last chapter. In this case, What you're doing is called classical counterconditioning because you're trying to counter an emotion that already exists. Classical counterconditioning is a powerful tool used by animal behaviorists to turn around behavior problems that are motivated by fear. As an applied animal behaviorist, I simply don't know what I'd do without it. The wonderful thing about this process is that once you understand the basics, you can use it on any kind of fear. I taught myself to be less nervous about public speaking by envisioning an audience in front of me and popping a Hershey's Kiss in my mouth. Even if you don't have a fearful dog, you might profit by reading the next section carefully. You never know when it might come in handy. Saving Blaze. Blaze, the troubled dog of the Irish priest, came home with me on Friday so that I'd have the weekend to settle him in. As usual, my partner Jim arrived after work, well warned about the dog who had already bitten 3 times. Before I brought Blaze home, I'd worked up a plan so we wouldn't have to make things up as we went along. We'd arrange that as Jim drove onto the farm, I would stand a good 50 yards away from his car with Blaze on a leash. When he got out, Jim was to stop and turn sideways to minimize any perceived threat, while I gave Blaze pieces of cooked chicken. I wanted Blaze to associate this visitor with something that made him happy. Blaze's emotions had other plans. Long before Jim got to the end of the driveway, Blaze was barking and lunging hysterically. His pupils were fully dilated and his commissure was retracted almost to his ears. He wouldn't have taken a piece of chicken if he'd been starving to death. He was too aroused to have any interest in food. Asking Jim to wait outside, I brought Blaze into the house and put him in his crate, which I'd put in a quiet room off the living room. Unlike many dogs, Blaze seemed to be calmer in a small space, perhaps because he couldn't generate the agitated energy that fed his emotions. Some dogs become more fearful if they're trapped, but Blaze's fears were exacerbated by a tendency to become overly aroused, so he actually did better when he was restricted to his crate when visitors entered. Once Blaze was settled, I gave him treats as Jim entered the house, knowing that he could hear and smell Jim, even though he couldn't see him. As the evening went on, Jim came and stood at the entrance to the room while I slid treats into the crate to Blaze. Eventually, Jim himself was able to sidle next to the crate, avoiding any direct eye contact, and push treats through the crate for Blaze. I continued that routine the next week, during which I'd ask visitors to drive up and stay outside until I came to get them. Every time I heard a car arrive, I'd take Blaze by the leash and put him in his crate, sliding treats into the crate until Blaze began to respond to the noise of a car as if he liked it. During the second week, I trained Blaze to run to his crate himself every time he heard a car drive up to the farm. On the third week, we practiced going into the crate when someone came to the door. If you have a dog who is frightened in any way of visitors, teaching him to move away from the door might seem counterproductive. However odd it seems, following that advice can eventually lead to a dog who happily greets visitors as they enter the house. If you first teach your dog to move away from the door, you are preventing surprise encounters when everyone is crammed together in the small, emotionally loaded space of a doorway. This is a good time to remember that every good treatment plan begins with a management plan to ensure the safety of your dog and your friends, and, as important, to prevent your dog from being conditioned in the wrong direction. Don't fool yourself into thinking that you can make everything hunky-dory by holding your dog by the collar as visitors enter. Remember, classical conditioning is about internal states, emotions, and the physiology that goes along with them. So forcing your dog into a situation that makes him nervous isn't going to solve the problem. It's going to make it worse. He'll be just as nervous, but now he'll also feel trapped because you've got a vice grip on his collar. That's not going to make him love visitors. It will condition him to be even more nervous about them. You can prevent trouble and prevent your dog from learning bad habits. I growl, they go away. Whew, got that figured out. By first teaching him to go into another room when there's someone at the door. Of course, your goal is to have a dog who happily greets visitors beside you at the door, but while you're working toward that, it's handy to have an alternative that allows you to manage the situation and avoid trouble. Use this alternative when a busy delivery person bangs on your door, when your Uncle George, the one who hates dogs, drops by to borrow a book, or when you're in a hurry yourself and can't follow the program described below. My dogs adore visitors, yet I find it handy to be able to send them into a closed room when certain kinds of company come. Even if your dog isn't aggressive, this is a great trick to teach her. Some of my clients have learned to dread visitors not because their dogs are aggressive, but because their pack goes so crazy when the doorbell rings that just opening the door qualifies as an adventure. How lovely to be able to ask your dogs to go into another room and open the door in peace and quiet. It's surprisingly easy to teach your dog to go away from the door after someone has knocked, although I say that with an awareness that many of you will be snorting with derisive laughter as you read this. If your dog seems to go stark raving crazy when the doorbell rings, you're not alone. If you'd like things to be a bit calmer, first understand that your chance of getting your dog's attention once he's barking hysterically at the door after a visitor has rung the bell is microscopic. The trick is to start before your dog launches himself into clinical hysteria by first practicing when the house is quiet and calm. Knock once or twice on the door yourself and then say, "Go to your place," in a happy tone, and lure your dog with a fistful of yummy treats into the designated area, an easily accessible room with a door or a crate in a quiet area of the house. Toss the treats onto the floor and shut the door. Wait just a few seconds, open the door, and let the dog out. Repeat that 4 or 5 times, all the while acting like it's a silly, fun game you're playing. After just a few sessions, most dogs eagerly run into the room and don't mind the door being shut for a brief period of time. Work your way up to real life by having family members go outside and knock on the door, and eventually to friends who are happy to put up with waiting a minute or two while you lure your dog into the other room. You might want to give your dog a hollow toy, like a Kong or a goodie ball, stuffed with food to keep him happy there while you chat with your visitors. Could we have some more company tonight? Teaching dogs to go into another room when visitors come not only manages the situation so that it's safe, it also begins the process of classical counterconditioning. Rather than being scared, aroused, and in the thick of things at the front door, your dog has been taken out of a situation that is over his head and has learned to associate the first signs of company with feeling calm, safe, and happy. "Ooh, I love it when I hear the bell ring or a knock on the door because that predicts I'm going to get chicken, and I love chicken!" The next step is to create a safe way to have your dog out of the crate and in the same room as a visitor. The key here is to be extremely aware of every little sight and sound that could act as a trigger for your dog's fears. Just as a drop in atmospheric pressure can scare a dog as much as thunder can, there are a variety of stimuli that act as classical conditioners to dogs who are afraid of strangers. Common initial triggers are the sound of a car in the driveway, the sound of the doorbell, and a knock on the door. The next set of triggers includes the sight of anyone standing at the front door rather than the one the family uses. The approach of an unfamiliar person, especially someone with a weird silhouette, produced by a backpack, a hat, or a huge beard, people with low, gruff voices, and the sight of a hand reaching out to pet them on the top of the head, or a visitor standing up from a couch or a chair. Keep in mind that having someone move toward your dog is very different to your dog from having your dog move toward them. Dogs are much more frightened of someone who approaches them than they are if the person or other dog stays still and lets the shy dog do the approaching. This is true of most animals. Temple Grandin relates in Animals in Translation that if you stand still inside a cow pen with a small white object, the cows will come over to investigate it. If you choose, on the other hand, to walk toward them with the same object in your hand, they'll spook and run away. The better you get at identifying these triggers, the better you'll be able to help your dog. Play the game now and ask yourself, what would be common triggers for dogs who have separation anxiety? There are lots of them, from taking just a few steps toward the door to picking up your car keys, putting on your jacket, or combing your hair in the bathroom. You can play the same game with dogs who are thunderphobic. They usually begin to pace and drool when the barometric pressure drops, when the wind comes up, or when the sky darkens. Dogs with mild cases don't react until the lightning starts or the first thunder rolls are heard. Whatever your dog's fears, it's critical to identify his triggers if you want to alleviate them. If you do have a fearful dog, sit down right now and figure out exactly what his triggers are. It doesn't matter if they make any sense to you. They have taken on the power to elicit fear in your dog, and that's all you need to know. Blaze's fear of strangers were typical in that he reacted to all the usual triggers. He could be set off first by a car's approach, then by a doorbell or knock on the door, then by the sight of a stranger, by that stranger approaching him or coming into the house, by a stranger looking directly into his eyes, or by a stranger reaching, horror of horrors, to pet him. Blaze was just as aroused when people left the house as he was when they entered it. I have seen this in a small percentage of other dogs, especially the herding breeds. And at first, couldn't generalize his acceptance of a person from one part of the house to another. After Blaze had accepted Jim completely, it seemed, he lunged at him in the garage 2 seconds after giving him a kiss in the adjacent room. We just had to add changing rooms to the triggers Blaze needed to learn to handle. Blaze's progress involved moving through each of those triggers one step at a time. After conditioning him to enjoy people driving up and entering the house when he was in his crate, I began to work on the next trigger. I needed Blaze to become more comfortable seeing people inside the house, but I wanted to avoid starting him with watching people entering through the doorway. Doorways are loaded locations to dogs, and I thought that he'd have a hard time accepting people walking in as he watched, even if he was on a leash far from the door itself. I did what behaviorists and trainers have been advising for years, which is to let the visitors enter the house without the dog seeing them. This avoided setting the dog off when someone violated the territorial boundary and allowed the dog to come out on a leash when the visitor was less threatening, quiet, and seated on the couch. Blaze and I played this game 4 weeks, thanks to a dedicated community of friends who took the time to drive out to the farm. A carload of 4 or 5 people would drive up, and as they did, Blaze and I would run to his crate and I'd tuck him inside with a treat. Then, one person at a time would come into the room and stand in the doorway while I slipped food into Blaze's crate. Next, they'd squat down, keeping their bodies sideways, as would any polite dog greeting another dog, and slip treats into the crate themselves. If Blaze looked relaxed and comfortable, I'd ask the visitor to go into the living room and sit down on the couch. Doors to the room safely shut, I'd let Blaze out of his crate, put on his leash, and walk him into the living room, using the door farthest from the couch. The first few times I did this, he barked and lunged at the visitor. Both of us ignored this foolishness and purposefully stayed quiet and relaxed. The visitor would begin tossing treats toward Blaze, and because we'd worked our way up to it, Blaze was relaxed enough to eat the treats, not the visitor. Then Blaze would go back into his crate. The visitor would leave and send in the next person, who started the process all over again. By visitor number 3, in just the first session, Blaze started to associate a person sitting on the couch with chicken falling from the sky. No more barks, no more lunges. By visitor number 5, Blaze was trotting out of his room looking for someone on the couch, his body loose, his mouth open, and his tail wagging. "Yo, got any chicken?" he seemed to be asking, and the visitor, well equipped for that very purpose, would oblige. If Blaze had become less relaxed as the list of visitors grew, then I would have stopped that session and backed up several steps for the next one. The next step was to have Blaze out of his crate, on a leash, of course, or he could have been behind a secure gate that kept him away from the door, when a visitor entered. In this phase, the visitors opened the door themselves and stood in the doorway, tossing treats like crazed flower girls refusing to walk down the aisle. Under no circumstances were they allowed to walk up to Blaze and try to hand him the treat. That would have been going way too far, way too fast. We were somewhere around step 5 in a 20-step process. Handing him the treats would be somewhere around step 15. If you're working with dog lovers who don't have a lot of knowledge, this is the trickiest part of the treatment plan. It seems everyone wants to be the one to hand your dog the treat. "It's okay," they say, when you ask them to throw the treat rather than hand it to the dog. "It's okay, I love dogs," they repeat, while they reach out to pet the dog cowering behind your legs. Humans seem to be hardwired with an almost uncontrollable need to touch a dog, whether you or the dog wants it or not, and it's hard to work around that. With respectful apologies to half the population, men tend to be worse about this. They often say, "Oh, it's okay, I'm not afraid of him." And so I suspect they misinterpret the instructions as concern for their well-being. Women more often say things like, "Oh, it's okay, dogs just love me." This is when a dinner party of behaviorists contemplating the universality of this behavior will simultaneously pick up their wine glasses and drain them in unison. In the nicest way possible, we try to explain to people that this procedure is not about them. It's about the dog. And yes, we understand that you're not afraid of the dog or that you're so special that out of all the people in the entire world, you'll be the one person whom the dog will not be afraid of. But please, 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 just this once, would you do what we ask for the dog's sake? Keep all this in mind if you're working on a treatment plan for your dog. Only ask friends to help you who will actually do what you ask, which, as we all know, turns out to be as hard for members of our own species as it is often for our dogs. It would take a whole book to describe the entire period I spent with Blaze and the next 2 months that he spent with a wonderful couple, Carol and Jim, who continued the process on their farm in northern Wisconsin. What I've written here is sufficient as a starter kit for dogs who are uncomfortable around strangers but haven't gotten themselves or you into trouble yet. You can use these methods to prevent defensive aggression in shy dogs and to manage and treat low-level problems in dogs who are nervous around strangers, but please don't take what I've written so far and start trying to treat a case of serious aggression without consulting a professional. You wouldn't try to neuter your own dog from information you got from a book, and treating aggression deserves to be taken as seriously as surgery. In both cases, a botched job can be fatal. This said, here is a summary of the process for those of you interested and able to pursue it. First, manage the situation so that no matter what happens, everyone is safe, saying, "I think it will be okay. Does you and your dog no favors?" Be sure that no one can get hurt or scared before you go any further. For example, when Blaze lived with me, I kept my door locked at all times so that no one could walk into my house unannounced. Second, write out a detailed list of everything that might be a trigger to your dog's fears. Get really good at observing your dog and at noticing subtle signs of tension. Do all that you can to avoid eliciting the wrong emotion, and all that you can to elicit the one you want. Third, figure out what your dog adores most and only let him have it right after the appearance of a trigger. Food works best for most dogs, but ball play can be a great tool in conditioning. I played ball with my noise-sensitive dogs every time the sky darkened before a thunderstorm. It didn't make them love thunder, but it stopped Pip from clawing my face into hamburger meat when it did. Fourth, link up the trigger with the treat, in that order, starting with the lowest possible intensity of whatever it is that scares your dog. Gradually increase the intensity. For example, in Blaze's case, linking treats with first a car driving up, then a person on the couch, then one walking through the doorway. Don't go too far too fast, which, sigh, is what most people do and why the paragraph above is so important. I didn't let Blaze anywhere near anyone except Jim for the first 6 weeks that I had him, and even then, it was only with dog training professionals whom I knew and trusted. Don't ever stop conditioning, whether for prevention or treatment. My dogs still get treats when workmen come to the house, even though they are elderly and they've always loved workmen. Be sure you understand that if you have a serious problem, you will have to manage it to some extent the rest of your dog's life. Again, don't do this by yourself if you have a dog who has injured someone or might do so. You wouldn't open up the back of your television and just start messing around with the stuff inside unless you knew what you were doing. So don't do the equivalent with your dog. Televisions can electrocute you. Dogs can hurt people and or get their owners sued. So do everyone a favor and take this to heart. There are lots of other things you can do for fearful dogs, from nutritional programs to exercise routines to trick training, but they are beyond the scope of this book. You can't fix everything, and that's okay. Blaze, I'm gratified to say, is fine now. He's living on a farm with a woman who understands border collies and has lots of other dogs, and he gets plenty of visitors to keep him used to company. I went to see him about a year after he'd stayed with me, and drove unannounced into the farmyard. Blaze was loose in the yard, and he ran toward my car with his tail wagging in huge, loose circles. Long before I think he recognized me, he was running up to me with his face open and relaxed, his eyes squinted, and his ears dipped in a friendly greeting. Lefty, the dog traumatized by the 12-year-old boy, is fine too. His family followed the steps described above, gradually exposing him to friendly men who came bearing treats and tennis balls, and eventually, with great care for safety, reintroducing the neighborhood children. The stories of Blaze and Lefty have the happiest of endings, but it's important to understand that not all stories turn out so well. No matter how good you are, you can't fix everything, any more than a great doctor can save everyone from a life-threatening disease. Blaze and Lefty had solid genetics behind them and the resources and commitment of a large number of people for a treatment plan. That's just not true for all dogs, no matter how much you love them. If you have a dog who is fearful, it's important to do what you can to alleviate those fears. No dog should have to live in fear all her life, and as the stories of Blaze and Lefty remind us, fearful dogs can sometimes be dangerous dogs. However, it's equally important to respect the essence of who your dog is. I work with and talk to professional dog trainers all over the country, and my impression is that many of us put too much pressure on ourselves to turn shy, inhibited dogs into bold, fearless ones. I don't know how many trainers I've talked to who broke down in tears of relief when they finally realized they didn't have to keep trying to fix a dog they got who simply wasn't suited for performing, or even for being comfortable at the dog park. Often, the trainers have been told that they just aren't skilled enough, or just not trying hard enough, when all along they have a dog who could no more do what they ask of her than most of us could win the Tour de France. Perhaps the saddest cases are families who have a beloved dog who simply can't tolerate the addition of a toddler to the house, no matter how much training and conditioning the owners are willing to do. I meet dogs who appear to be flat-out miserable about a new child in the family, not so much because they are jealous, but because they can't tolerate the noise and unpredictability of a little human scrambling around the house. Although many cases can be resolved, sometimes the only thing to do is to find the dog a quieter home, hard as that is on the family who loves him. Greater love hath no human. And greater love had no humans than Blue's owners, who dedicated themselves to curing his thunder phobia. I had been worried, terribly worried, about his prognosis. It would have helped greatly if we could have brought him inside, but Blue couldn't do his job from the living room. Neither could he be medicated and still perform his job. "Hey, dear, how's it going?" Or be safe outside by himself. In addition, thunder phobias are especially tricky because you can't ask the storms to represent themselves in a gradually increasing series of intensities throughout the summer. We did the best we could. Barb and Dave built him the finest safe house a working dog has ever had. They constructed a huge igloo-like doghouse, insulated with over 2 feet of straw to dampen the transmission of sound. It had a double entrance so that Blue could crawl inside and turn 90 degrees to the right into a cozy dark den and well protected from the storm. For 6 weeks, Barb practiced a counter-conditioning program. She ran to the doghouse at the first sign of an approaching storm, crawled into the house with Blue, and gave him lamb and chicken every time she heard the faintest crack of thunder. Every night that summer, I lay in bed thinking of poor Barb, hiking across the fields to Blue whenever a storm came up. A few times I hauled myself out of bed and drove to their farm, ran across the mud in the pouring rain, and sat with Barb in a communal mix of misery and shared excitement, while Blue licked our faces and snarfed down chicken. There were a lot of storms that summer, good for curing Blue's phobias in some ways, hard on Barb and Blue and others. One night, yet another storm rolled in, but this time Barb was out of town. Husband Dave thought it was time to see if we'd made any progress, so he got out the binoculars and looked to see what Blue would do when the first thunderbolt sounded. Bless his heart, Blue ran to his safe house and stayed there until the storm passed, the emotion of fear countered by the cozy goodness of cuddling up in his house while the storm raged outside. Blue was fine all the rest of the summer, guarding the growing vegetables from the hungry mouths of deer, staying off the highway in storms, preferring his safe house to the dangers of the open road. I wish I could tell you he's still there, but one morning the next spring, Barb and Dave found him lying dead in the field. He'd been healthy as a horse the day before, and he didn't have a mark on him. The vet thinks, perhaps, his heart gave out. Although Blue's death was a great sadness to Barb and Dave, they are buoyed by the knowledge that his last year was full of comfort rather than fear. Thanks to their dedication, the storms that had been a terror to Blue became a mere inconvenience. I think of him still, snoozing on a patch of rich black soil, soaking up the summer sun during the day, on guard all the night, watching over the farm like the good dog he was, taking care of the special people who took such good care of him.